the service and came out together, and he wanted to stop in Los Angeles on the way back home to see a brother of his that he hadn't seen for many years. And so we were driving in his car. I said, "That's fine." He said, "Well, I guess before we get there, I should tell you my brother's married to a black woman." I said, "Does that make any difference?" I said, "No." I said, "It doesn't make any difference to me." He said, "Well," he said, "I thought I should ask you because the reason I haven't seen my brother in all these years is he's been disowned by my family and hasn't been allowed to come home." And I can remember at the time how I felt inside, how a family could disown their own flesh and blood because they married someone they loved. And so anyway, that really touched me, and I guess probably through the rest of my years, I've been concerned about the racial problem in particular, and many other social problems, which they're so prevalent in this country, where there are the extreme poor and the extreme rich, and it seems like there should be some controls on how poor a person should be allowed to get and how rich a person should be allowed to get. But anyway, as after I got out of the service, I got married and had 5 children. I was a little bit skeptical of religion because I had been raised a Catholic and we weren't allowed to marry someone that had been married before. I married a woman who had been married before, so I figured if God's going to condemn somebody for the rest of their life because they had made a mistake, I didn't want to have much to do with it. So, anyway, my wife was a Christian, though. She belonged to the Disciples of Christ denomination, which happens to be the same denomination that Jim Jones was affiliated with. She talked me into going to the church, and I met a person who was involved in a social action department. Well, I thought, that sounds interesting. If they're willing to do something about the problems of the world, then I'll go ahead and be involved. I later became social action chairman of the Council of Churches of West Contra Costa County. And at that time, they were working on a program called Open Housing Covenant, which was to allow people of all race to move into your neighborhood, regardless of the religion or anything else. I'd worked real hard on this program, and when I brought the program back to my local denomination, asking the board to give me permission to let the congregation give prayerful consideration to the signing of this covenant, after a lot of fuss, they finally decided no, that I couldn't present this to the members of my church. So at that time, I figured that I had enough religion and gave up, because they really weren't concerned about anything except building their church building, getting new members in to help pay for this building, and dressing up nice on Sunday so that people could see them. So I was really disenchanted with religion at that point. But I did find a few ministers who felt pretty much the same way as I did about religious, the organized religion. And we worked in what you call the Richmond City Inner City Ministry, which was to help poor people in the ghettos understand that they had power within the city, they had a voice. We helped them go to city council meetings to express their concerns about the discrimination in fire protection, for instance, in their area, street cleaning in their area. It seems like, the more money you had, the better neighborhood you lived in, the better you were taken care of by the city. But when these people did voice their
their objections to being discriminated against, there were some changes made. When I worked at Standard Oil, there was no blacks hired there except in a janitorial capacity. I had worked there probably for 7 years, 7 to 10 years before they hired their first black person in anything other than janitorial. And so I was very unhappy at my job. I had spoken out to my fellow employees about the discrimination practices. I'd written letters to the editor of the local newspaper stating that Standard Oil was discriminating against blacks. And strangely enough, they read the letter thinking that I was complimenting them on, I had complimented them on hiring their first black, but stated that they had been discriminating for a long period of time. Well, after the letter, they called me in and thanked me for the letter and hired 10 more blacks within a week. So, but still, Standard Oil did discriminate. They had 3,500 employees when I worked there. At that time, when I quit, they had 2,500. When I quit my laboratory position, they still had not hired a black person in the laboratory, and I said, before I quit, I painted myself black and went to work for a week. And I told them this was my protest against them, their hiring practices, and that I would be your nigger. And they're extremely frightened and fearful of me all the time I was there. They didn't know whether I was going to do something drastic. What does this maniac going to do, you know? So when I quit, I actually was quitting to join People's Temple in Redwood Valley, California. But I wanted my quitting to have some meaning there. So when I quit, I told them that I was quitting so that they would have room to hire a black person and that they would have no further excuse not to hire me. But they did not hire a black person when I quit. They didn't hire anybody. They were cutting down on their number of employees because of automation. But before I quit Standard Oil, after I worked on the Open Housing Covenant program, I was so discouraged because it seemed to have no meaning to anyone. Few people were willing to sign a paper saying I'm willing to accept anyone in my neighborhood regardless of their race, color, or creed. Because it also said that they would be willing to have their name published in the local newspaper as to witness to the fact that they would. And even though many may have been willing to accept, they weren't willing to let their neighbors know that they were willing to have blacks or to sell blacks or whatever. So at that time, I felt the only way anything is really accomplished is by doing things yourself. My wife and I happened to be selling our house in an all-white neighborhood, and we wanted it made perfectly clear that everyone was welcome. So I advertised. I didn't want it to sound like I was particularly soliciting to black people to buy my house. So I said, for sale by owner to you or you, thinking possibly somebody would pick up what it meant. And I kept getting these calls, are there any blacks in the neighborhood? Are there any niggers in the neighborhood? And I told my wife, I said, this is ridiculous. I said, the only way the black people are going to know that they're welcome in the neighborhood, I didn't get any calls from black people, is to advertise all welcome. And I did. And the first person that answered the call was a black person. They bought the house. And my wife and I lived in the house for a month after we had sold to black people. And then we learned what discrimination is really like. The mayor of the treasury of San Pablo, the city I was living in,
tried to bribe us and into not going through with the sale on the house. The neighbors wouldn't let their children play with our children. We were threatened, had threatening phone calls. The neighbors met on a lawn across the street from my house, obviously threatening. My wife went over and asked if she could be involved in this discussion that they were having. And they said, well, we tried to talk to you already. We don't want to talk to you. I guess you know the whole neighborhood's against you. And my wife was a spunky person. She says, well, I hope that makes you feel big. All you people over there against us over here. And stormed away. But then came the incident in Alabama with Martin Luther King. I told you I'd been involved with some ministers who were not particularly happy with the conventional churches either. And they were more interested in ministering to people on a personal level rather than in a denominational level to get to the real needs. And when Martin Luther King made the call for all ministers to come to Selma, Alabama and protest against the death of Reverend Reeb, I believe it was, I was asked to go, and so I went. And I thought if there was ever a true church, I experienced it in Selma, Alabama. It was more the persecution that you heard about the Christians experience for standing up to their rights, for demonstrating. I really believed at that time in Martin Luther King's theory of nonviolence. Although in recent years I've learned that you can't let people beat on you forever and ever because some people never get tired of beating. But his theory was that, you know, let them beat and just someone else lay on top, and after one person had enough to absorb some of the punishment. Well, I think I've pretty much covered my social background before I went to People's Temple. I had divorced my first wife, or we had gotten a divorce after 17 years of marriage, and I had remarried. My wife's name was Deanna. The one mentioned, my new wife is Deanna, the one mentioned by Jim Jones in the death tape in Jonestown. He considered her and Tim Stone, the lawyer, whose son was the biggest controversy in the whole scene between Jonestown and people, the concerned relatives here in the United States. My wife and I were told by the minister that had married us that he was going up to Redwood Valley to listen to see this guy, Jim Jones, who he had seen before, and he was bringing a large group of people up on a bus, so they might see too. He had brought his whole congregation, or at least those that would follow him from Indianapolis to Indiana, to Northern California, and supposedly because he had a squabble with his church back there because he had appointed an associate pastor, a black associate pastor, which broke up the congregation into factions. Supposedly this is the reason they came to California. He was involved in trying to influence legislation to make things better for the blacks, better job opportunities, better housing, etc. He was getting young people off of drugs. He supposedly had 40 young people that were off of drugs and working full time to make us a better world to live in. He was concerned about senior citizens. He had senior citizens' homes.
Well, I thought this must be some fantastic person. And so my wife and I decided to go up with him and see Jim Jones at People's Temple. And it was quite an experience. We walked in, there was this beautiful music. You had the music of like Blowing in the Wind, songs like We Shall Overcome, all the songs crying out for social change, you know. And it just sounded beautiful. I was a little turned off, and so was my wife, of the healing. When we first arrived, people started telling us they were dealing with cancer, and they were protected from accidents. I had never believed in this particular philosophy, or I never believed in psychics or anything like that before I joined People's Temple. People got up and testified to Jim Jones how he had done all these miraculous things, how he would get up in the middle of the night to go minister to someone that he had psychically picked up something was wrong with. One lady told about how they were in a board meeting and he had to suddenly leave, and she went with him, and they went to this house where this man had had a quarrel with his wife and had shot himself in the head. And he was laying there on the floor bleeding, seemingly dead, and Jim Jones had leaned over, put his hand on this man's forehead and tenderly loved him, and the bullet bounced out of his forehead, and the man was a whole. I mean, this stuff was really tight, you know. People sincerely telling you this stuff from the bottom of their heart, they saw it, you know. And other people would testify to the fact that, yeah, I saw this woman grow up with cancer. Well, sure enough, first, we did go to more meetings. We saw these things happen, too. But before I get into that, the church was a very loving church, warm church. You went in and immediately you were their friend. They talked to you, they embraced you. The church was not built on a
order of a regular church. We have all your churchly things. There was a swimming pool in the back of the church. All the chairs were folding chairs. After the service, they'd pick the chairs up, put up tables, have a big banquet dinner, and continue on with the evening meal. And if it was nice weather, it would be announced ahead of time that they'd be going for a swim that evening or that afternoon. They'd play games, family games. Jim used to say, the family that plays together stays together. But all of these things, as years went on, we realized were just tricks. Because very little of it he did each of these things for a short period of time. Like the game playing was maybe two or three times. Just to attract maybe certain people. He had such charisma that he could speak to a diverse group like this, saying two or three totally different things, but every one of you would be hearing what you wanted to hear. He'd be saying just exactly what you believe in. And the other things that you might have picked up that weren't meant for you, you would hear it said that he had to say those for someone who needed that, which put you in a little higher position. We went to the first meeting, and then we went home. My wife, during the first meeting, he had said that there were errors in the Bible, and my wife. Second wife had come from a very religious background, Seventh-day Adventist, and she knew the Bible quite well. And she knew there were no errors in the Bible. And he started telling what the errors in the Bible were. But she didn't believe it. She wasn't looking around for a Bible, but there weren't any there. And so at one point he said that, if there's a God in the heaven, he wouldn't let me condemn his Bible. But there's no God in heaven.
if there's a God in heaven, let him strike me dead. You know, just like that. I mean, he had charisma. You wouldn't believe. And my wife was so religious. She sat there and she just waited. She knew that God was going to strike me dead. She waited and waited. And Joan said, I have a feeling someone's waiting. And then she's like this, you know. So we went home. She looked up in the Bible and realized that the things that he had said were true, that there were errors in the Bible. A good number of errors in the Bible, and which I would say to any of you who try to find any ultimate truths, be careful, because if that becomes your God, the Bible becomes your God, and somebody destroys it, you're very vulnerable at that point to taking on the one that destroyed it as your God. I mean, that goes for relationships, marriage, anyway, to your, you know, your ideal friends. Don't set them up too high, because they'll disappoint you sometimes. Allow them to be human. I think one of the things, I don't know how much you want me to go into our experiences in People's Temple. I can go into them with questions. One thing I...
one of the things we had to conclude when we came out of People's Temple was that we were fools. And, you know, that we had been fooled and we were fools. And I think a good lesson for everyone to learn is to be able to admit that you've been a fool. Because if you can't admit you were a fool, you'll continue to be one. Because you're already trying to fool yourself. Jim Jones, we had tried to say was good, and we had been following a good man, and he turned bad. But the more we analyze it, everything that seemed good, the black and white together, turned out that Jones was a racist all along. He had adopted a black son for the purpose of showing that he wasn't prejudiced. He had put in a black associate minister to appeal to black people. The black associate minister had no power whatsoever, had no voice. He was a puppet. I mean, he was just something to show, a figurehead. His love that he showed for children was all put on. You can't love children and then turn around and beat them and laugh while they're being beaten. You can't watch love senior citizens and then make them go up and box a retarded person till she's bleeding and to the point of where guards have to hold her up and continually make these black seniors box this person. You can't love and do these things. I mean, you can't love people and take them to a jungle with 100 miles of wall around and then murder them. Those were not suicides in Jonestown. Those were murders. You don't commit suicide with guns to your head or being injected with cyanide. Some of the people may very well have wanted to die to get out of their misery. Some may have decided to go ahead and commit suicide because they've seen their children already killed. What have they got left to live for, you know? There were people that killed themselves, but it was murder. Okay, I think I'm going to leave the rest to... I do have some several things. I've got some Human Freedom Center brochures here. If any of you would like them to know about what the Human Freedom Center is about. And it's very possible that many of you know someone that is in a cult group or in a group that you might consider a cult. A group having a leader that has complete control over their mind, their actions, what they do.
We have books at the Human Freedom Center. Here's one called Deceived. It was written about the Human Freedom Center, basically, when it was at the time of the Jonestown crisis, when we all were there together with the state police, the city police, the FBI, everyone was there to protect us. So this is an extremely good book. The best book that's been written to date, or published to date. My wife's book, which I think is probably
the best, being a little prejudiced.
It comes out in hardback, and it's been written up in the New York Book of Reviews. It's an excellent book. She's been able to put our daily lives, our feelings, our emotions at the time
all of these things were taking place while we were in the temple.
She wrote this book not to be published. Originally, she wrote the book because we knew we were going to be killed by Jim Jones because we had come out publicly against him.
And we wanted the word in print somewhere where someone might someday know the true People's Temple, the true Jim Jones. And she had this book
recorded
in Sacramento so that it couldn't be destroyed.
We had a reason
to believe we were going to be killed. We had been threatened many times. Our bank where we had our documents against People's Temple had actually been bombed. And they bragged about bombing it, and that they would get our stuff. Our children with that on their way to school. But I will let you answer questions. I don't believe you learned anything by me standing here talking about things you may not be interested in hearing. If you have questions, then I know you want to hear what I have to say about that particular question anyway. So. Yes?
You
left
People's Temple before the Jonestown incident?
Yes, my wife and I were in People's Temple for 6 years, and we left September 1975.
What was it that appealed to the people that after they seen the bad side of Jim Jones, that they continued to follow him?
Well, it's hard to admit you've been wrong. And things weren't bad all of a sudden. Things were very good.
First, sort of like a marriage or boyfriend, girlfriend. You know, you get into them and they're beautiful. Gradually, maybe you learn the true side of the other person. But you don't want to see that other side maybe bad. You want to think of that person as being this great person. And as you keep seeing a little more and a little more, then you go through a phase of, well, I want to change this person, you know. I want him to be the beautiful person I want him to be, so I'll change you. And we went through that with Jim Jones, thinking that maybe we could change him. He had the charisma. He could get people. He could rally people around him. Whereas working for the Social Action Department of the Council of Churches, if I were to ask people to write letters to the congressman, I might get one letter. If Jim Jones said, write letters to your congressman, everybody in the church wrote letters. Not one letter, but maybe 10 letters. So there were thousands of letters going out from People's Temple. You felt like you were a part of a movement that wouldn't stop. It was sort of the feeling that we had in Selma, Alabama with Martin Luther King. I mean, we were on top, you know, and we were going to win. Next question.
I'm interested in, you were saying earlier that you at the first meeting you heard testimony of how he cured people of cancer and et cetera, and then later on you yourself saw this. And what kinds of things did you see?
Well, the first thing I saw was that people coming out of the restaurants, supposedly
having passed a cancer. And, you know, he would say they had cancer, send them in with a nurse. The nurse would come out carrying a gob of meat, you know, and stunk like hell, and you'd think it was cancer. And I didn't know if it was cancer or not. I didn't see it. But that wasn't why I came there. I didn't go to People's Temple for the healings. I went there because
the man seemed to be interested in senior citizens, children, and changing the society into being a more equitable society. He was able to tell people things about their lives that seemed to be real, to me, even to me at the time. And I'm a real doubter. I mean, he told my wife and I that we had someone living with us named Mary, who was my wife's mother. We had a dog named Shep, and that we had a little wagon, a little red wagon. Something wrong with the steering mechanism. You better check it. I'm afraid one of your kids are going to have an accident. Well, we lived quite a ways away. We lived in Hayward, and he was up in Redwood Valley, and he was seeing this stuff in his mind, I thought. And it wasn't until after we had even left the church that we really knew what went on. I mean, they had people going to people's garbage cans. They would go to your house, maybe in a PJD truck, or, you know, or act like a salesman, a book salesman. They could look through your window, see things. Maybe you had something propped up on your piano, you know, something very special. Or you'd find an envelope in your garbage can addressed to your Aunt Sarah back in Missouri. He could tell you, well, you have an Aunt Sarah. I say she lives in Missouri. Let's see the address. You're coming, you know. And he could give you the address. All was written down right on the front. And that was one of the reasons he wore the dark glasses, because his eyes were looking down here. It looked like he was looking straight ahead at you. He had people working in an office, typing up all this information on what they call them revelation sheets. And in my wife's book, you'll see copies of revelation sheets, and with Jim Jones' handwriting on them, hauled out such and such a day, healed of cancer. And it wasn't until after we got out of the church that we found out what these cancers were like. I mean, how they did it. They rotted chicken guts out of the meat parts, put them in little plastic bags, and then the nurse would come up to you in a meeting after he told you all these things that no way he could possibly know. I mean, and when somebody starts telling you stuff like that, you're out here, you're really stoned, you know. And he says, and you have a cancer in your throat. If I didn't heal you, you would die two months from now or something like that, you know. And the person, you know, just really don't know what to do. He says, open your mouth. And he says, I'm going to send a nurse down to you, and you're going to pass the cancer. And he'd do it right in front of everybody. She'd have this goblet of Kleenex in her hand, you know, with the plastic bag hidden, I guess. And I took pictures of the healing. I was right there. Oh, it's right there, and I didn't see. I never saw them actually stick this plastic bag in the mouth. But I knew that a hand always went in the mouth before anything came out. I always thought maybe they were just trying to gag them or something, so they'd throw it up. But what they did, they would poke this plastic bag in where it would break, and then pull it out, and this horrible smelling meat, you know, comes out. And people are gagging. I mean, can you imagine them putting something like that in your mouth? And then you have to spit it out. But then Father, he was so loving. He always had his juices and stuff that he had to drink up the front, cranberry juice, grapefruit, for his revelation to give him. He needed this energy from the juice. So he would pour a glass of juice. Here, give that to that lady. She needs that for her healing, you know. And it tasted damn good after you had that crappy meat. You know. There are pictures of that in her book too. You can see the hand going in the mouth, and you can see the cancer in the Kleenex afterwards.
Yes. So these people were supposedly healed were part of the hoax. They realized that
no. The
was putting something in
the
they didn't realize at all.
These people didn't realize. They were, I mean, they didn't know somebody stuffed that plastic thing down there, you know, and punctured it and pulled it out. I mean, when something like that happens, you're in such a state that you don't know what's going on anyway. I can remember the first time he called out my name. My God, I didn't know. My head just seemed to sort of pulsate or something, you know. I don't know whether the man actually hypnotized people or what. There's some speculation that he did have a real gift at one time, but that he found an easy way to do it and lost it here. I don't know.
Did you already watch him ask him?
No. No, he usually picked people that were from Pentecostal background. On the revelation sheets, he would put, the people that made him up would say, she's very intelligent, medium intelligent, dumb, gullible, you know. So Jones, a lot of times they'd have somebody go around talking to the person to get a little idea what the person's like. But Jones had a real good idea, a real good profile on this person before he ever called them out.
I'm curious about the events that caused you and your wife to realize that he was really bad, or it must have taken a series of different events.
Yeah. Well, the difficult thing, I don't think I fully answered your question before. When he got caught up in people's temple, after a period of time where you might show some objections, you had already been compromised. Because, you know, you're talking such a beautiful thing going on, you know. We're going to change the world. It's going to be a beautiful world. We all were happy. Hugged one another, sang beautiful songs. He would say that there will be people here that will go out and betray me. There are Judases.
All these Judases.
Just to show your faith, show that you won't go out and do any harm to this group, we ask you to write a letter stating you would kill the President of the United States. I mean, this is a letter that, you know, is damaging to you, but I'll never use it. It's just to show that you have, that you'll never leave this group and that you're totally dedicated. Or that you have molested your child, or that you participated in particular bank robbing on such and such a day, that you were involved in the Roseville bombing. We had to write probably 60 letters all the time we were in there in our own handwriting and sign. Plus, later on, you had to sign blank sheets of paper.
Every time you came into a service, you had to sign a blank sheet of paper. And they could put, he would say this was for his revelation sheet. What the hell that meant, I don't know, you know, but
paper was.
You just didn't object to doing anything he said after that. I mean, you were in.
As far as you never really thought you were
going to leave the group. I never thought I'd leave the group. Things would get bad. I might want to quit. My wife would want to stay. Or vice versa.
And until we could get to the point where we both wanted to quit at the same time, we couldn't make it out.
Most people were in a different situation.
My wife and I, the families had been broken up.
Their children were living with other families. And you weren't allowed to talk to one another. You were never allowed to say anything against Jim Jones. So that if I particularly
had a grievance against Jim, I wouldn't go to my wife and say, hey, you know, what happened to what I read on Hopeful? Because my wife
would have to turn me in.
But my wife and I had made an agreement that we would never stop
talking to one another, and that if we ever left, we'd leave together. And that we'd never stop having sex with one another. Because these were the things that he got people to do.
Gradually.
You know, first he said,
husband and wife shouldn't sit together
in a congregation. Because there are many older people in here who have no husband or no wife. Right. Maybe they've died. And they feel lonely
when they see you enjoy one another's company. No.
So don't sit together. You're just flaunting your love in front of others.
He did the same thing with integration.
Everyone's supposed to sit black and white, black and white, black and white. If you saw two black people sitting together, you were to go sit between them. Or if they saw two white people, they would sit between them. We were supposed to show total equality,
total integration.
Did I answer your question this time?
No.
Go ahead.
Okay. What I'm asking is, I understand all these things, but what I mean is, you saw some inequities, or you saw that Jones wasn't
right.
doing what he was saying. And I'm wondering, what were the things that really keyed you to want to leave the people's
okay,
story?
What finally got to me was it's hard to say. The final straw was when I had criticized Jim Jones, unless we wrote in a letter or did it personally. Very few people could get to Jones personally. I was one that could. He was giving a black girl 75 whacks with this board. I mean, this board was brutal. It was a 3/4-inch board, about 2.5 inches wide and 2.5 feet long. And my daughter got 75 whacks, and her butt looked like a hamburger afterwards. And anyway, he was giving 75 whacks to this black girl. She had stolen a dime store item. I believe it may have been a natural comb or an earring or something that she thought she really needed, you know, and she didn't have money to buy it. So she was getting 75 whacks for this. There was a white boy that had stolen a car several weeks prior and had been punished. And then this time he was up for stealing a woman's purse out of her car. And it was happened to be a prominent person in the Ukiah area, and they were concerned about the fact that she might find out that it was a temple person that did it and might cast aspersion to the temple. But this young black boy was getting, the young white boy was getting 10 whacks and being sent to the, quote, promised land. To everybody in the congregation, the promised land was Jonestown. It was a desirable place to go to. And I had noticed the prejudice before, and I hadn't spoke out, but this time I wrote him a note. Explained to him what he was doing. I said, this is prejudice. And he turned around, called me up to the podium, and he said, Merle, you don't understand. I sure don't understand. And so I was one of the few people who had freedom of motion in the auditorium because I was a photographer and I could move around anytime or any place I wanted to take pictures of Jim or anyone else. So I just casually packed up my camera gear and left. I went out and sat in the car. When my wife came out, I told her that I was never going back. And she said, well, honey, we can't just quit like that. I said, she said, they'll know we're quitting. I said, well, I don't care. I said, I'm not going back to another meeting. She said, well, there's a planning commission meeting tonight, and you just don't go. I mean, you go to planning commission meetings, you don't stay away. But I told her I wasn't going. And so I wrote a more elaborate letter to Jim Jones for her to take with her to the planning commission meeting, stating the inequities in the punishments, just a lot of the grievances I had had against him. And he got very hostile at that particular meeting when my wife gave him this letter. He read it out publicly, which made him look like an ass because everything I had said was true and everyone there knew it was true, but couldn't talk to anyone about it, couldn't admit it to themselves or him. But he put my wife through a lot that night, and she kept saying, well, you'll just have to talk to Myrtle. I don't know, you know. By the way, our names were Elmer and Deanna Myrtle in the church, and they were changed to Al and Jeannie Mills after we got out of church because of all the documents we had signed. But this was the reason I finally quit. There were a lot of reasons. My wife and I were moving from Redwood Valley to the Bay Area because that's where the church was relocating in San Francisco. We were both working full-time for the church, and neither of us were making any outside money, so we were totally dependent upon the church for our food and clothing. We had, I believe it was 14 children at that time that we were taking, not all of them ours, but other children of the church. And my wife had asked for some money, and they said, well, you'll have to see so-and-so. So she saw so-and-so, and so-and-so said, well, I'm sorry, I can't give you. She went back to Jim Jones, said she had to have some money for food. And he said, well,
I don't want to get involved in that. You see so-and-so. He said, I already did. And they said, no. And he said, well, just talk to me later about it. I can't talk to you about it now. And so she talked to him again about it. She said, look, she says, my parents who aren't in the church and my husband's mother are supporting these kids. And, you know, we gave everything we have to the church, and we work full-time for the church. The church is supposed to feed us and take care of our children. And she said, if we don't get any money, we'll have to send them back to the church. They had a commune at the church. So he said, okay, send them back. Well, that really crushed us because we were really in love with these kids that we had, that they had to go back because we couldn't afford to feed them. And that was one of the things that made us quit. Here he had said, you know, I'll take care of you. Father will always take care of your needs. And here at the time when we needed some money to feed kids that weren't even ours, we couldn't get any money. Just a sec. There was one other incident where he had sent me to Redwood Valley to help rehab some of the houses to get them ready to sell because they needed the money to go to Guyana. They wanted to get all their assets out of Redwood Valley. But while I was there, my wife was trying to run a rest home, take care of 14 children, and our house got broken into. We had a few items that we did have, like a tape recorder and a movie camera. We didn't have a lot of stuff. We had a television, and they were stolen. And it really hurt me, the fact that he would have my wife stay down there with all these children and have to do all this work by herself and send me away. So I, at that time, said, I was moving back. I didn't give a damn what happened, you know. And I did, and nobody gave me a gun. Excuse me.
No, what can
she asked
about my wife at the time, the Bible heirs, whether or not she was disappointed because God didn't strike Jim Jones dead. I'm sure now she is. At the time, she was probably disappointed then because she was sure of herself. But he was telling the truth. And there were numerous errors.
In fact, my wife
later wrote a book called The Letter Killer and pointed out all the errors in the Bible. Well, they're minor errors. I mean, some may be typographical and some may not. I don't want to get into discussing the Bible, but
I don't understand how she really believed that the Bible was true. How he could change her mind, because there might be errors and there might not be, but if you believe in something, if there are errors, you still believe in it. Because it's something like religion. I don't understand if you believe in it or you don't.
Well, that's the way I pointed out, it's sort of like,
I don't see how it changed her mind and said, oh, after you've been raised, let's say you've been raised to be.
Well, you didn't do it just with the Bible. I mean, he pointed out that there were errors in the Bible. And he pointed out to her, you know, if there's a loving God up there, why are there so many people, little babies, starving to death? Why did this happen to somebody and not to someone? Why can't somebody go through their whole lifetime